Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, The Coddling of the American Mind, moderated by Malcolm Gladwell, with an outstanding panel, three names that we should all know. Haidt, that's H-A-I-D-T, a professor, outstanding person in his insights of what the heck has happened to just civil discourse, of being able to go to college and go there with the intent of, yes, enjoying yourself and socializing, but learning how to be a critical thinker, raising the bar in your own life. Well, he's here, as is a Skinze and Lukianoff. These are three heavyweights. We're now going to hear a panel discussion at the 92nd Street Y on their interpretation of what's happening with our woke culture, and people are offended by things that quite simply should not be offensive to anyone. After all, when you and I were going to college, we weren't told that we were going there to be coddled. No, we were going there to learn how to be critical thinkers, to gain insights, to prepare us for the real world outside. Not so in much of the academic world today. Now, to this discourse.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you to all of our guests for joining us this evening. I wanted to start with each of you. Lenore, why don't you start? I want each of you to describe how you came to this issue.
For me, the free-range kids issue? Well, as you just heard, I let my 9-year-old ride the subway alone. Actually, it wasn't just me. It was me and my husband, who's out there somewhere, America's worst dad. thank God I actually don't see him. But anyways, the reason we had let him do this was because he felt he was ready for it, and we know our city, we know our kid, and it seemed like if he was ready, we were ready. And I didn't write the column about it immediately because it wasn't a publicity stunt, although had I known. When I did write it, the blowback was so immediate, I really hadn't realized how scared my generation of parents had become to let their kids do anything on their own, even though we all grew up loving our freedom as kids. And the disconnect between the way we were raising our own kids and the way we appreciated being raised just struck me as bizarre, and I've just been, you know, sort of exploring my way through it since.
You say you were unaware of how afraid your generation had become as parents. But you must have been at least partially aware if you
wrote
thought it was
column.
Worthy of an article to write about how your kid was writing
the
cover, right?
That's why he has five bestsellers. Got one. Just write for a minute. Here's what happened. We let him ride the subway, and then I didn't write about it immediately because it didn't strike me as that big a deal, but I was talking to some of the other fourth grade parents, and they were like, "You did what?" And I was like, "Yeah, we let him ride the subway," and they were going to wait till their kids were older, like 38 or 39, and when I heard that, I wanted to write it, but I have to confess that when I looked back at old columns of mine, I used to be at the Daily News, not anymore, anyway, I found columns of mine from when they were like 4 and 6, and I said, yeah, I let them go to the bathroom at the New Victory Theater without me traipsing their boys, without me going in. Is that terrible? And I let them play downstairs in our courtyard when they were, I don't know, 7 and 9. Is that so terrible? And so I realized that had been a theme, which was I just didn't understand why we were so afraid of strangers. I'm a reporter by trade. All I do is talk to strangers. So that really got my gall. And as a reporter, I knew that the crime rate today is lower than when we were growing up. So between not letting our kids do anything and having the reason be because times have changed, it just didn't make sense to me. And I just hate hysteria. I know I sound slightly hysterical, but I hate hysteria. And that's really what wakes me up every day and like, I gotta fight this fight.
Yeah. John and Greg, how did you come to what was behind the original, this foray into,
actually, you should
led
start
to the book, Coddling America?
Well, first thing I want to say as a disclaimer is that I'm recovering from a concussion from a car accident. So if I say anything stupid, that's the concussion. But if I say anything really good, that's all me. So I was the weird person who went to law school specifically to do First Amendment law. I took every class that my law school offered. I did 6 credits on censorship during the Tudor dynasty when I ran out of classes to take on the First Amendment. I interned at the ACLU of Northern California. This was my lifelong passion. And I started working for a new organization. I became the first legal director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. And even back in 2001, it was easier to get in trouble for what you said on a college campus than most people thought. But at the time, who you'd get in trouble with was overwhelmingly administrators. There was this kind of conservative stereotype about students being the ones reporting their professors and demanding speech codes, and that was just not true. Another kind of curveball in the story is, a little bit of a dark turn, is around 2007, I had a very bad bout of depression, like a scary, hopefully the worst I'll ever have, and I ended up being hospitalized for it. And the thing that really helped me deal with, and I had issues with depression my whole life, but the thing that really made these battles winnable, pretty much from this point on, was cognitive behavioral therapy. So I was working on campus defending freedom of speech while trying to train myself to not catastrophize a cognitive distortion that can make you anxious and depressed, to not personalize, to not engage in black and white thinking, to not overgeneralize. All these things are cognitive distortions that depressed and anxious people do a lot. And amazingly, if you get in the habit of talking back to those kind of exaggerated voices, it's very effective at dealing with anxiety and depression. And I was watching on campus administrators, in my opinion, exercising modes of behavior that seemed to be saying to students, you're in great danger all the time. And at the time I was like, well, but thank goodness students aren't taking these lessons to heart. And unfortunately, that seemingly changed overnight. 2013, 2014, at the time we had no clue exactly why. Students who used to be the best constituency for free speech on campus suddenly became, to some degree, sort of like the stereotypes people have of the don't you dare say that kind of attitude very, 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 very quickly. And what was strange about it was that they were sort of medicalizing the reasons for it. They were saying, not, I don't want this guy on my campus because I hate him and he's a bigot. I don't want this guy speaking on my campus because it will be psychologically harmful. To people I know, usually not to me, but to other people. Other unnamed people will be harmed by their presence. And this sounded exactly like what I was frightened was going to happen in terms of sort of bad pseudo-medicalization, pseudo-psychological thinking. Mm-hmm. I'd recently become friends with John, and we went to get lunch at an Indian place down in the village, and we chatted about the idea, and to my delight, he wanted to write an article about it.
So. John, are there were there specific incidents in your own experience that led you to think that there was a broader trend going on?
Yeah. So I've been teaching since 1987 when I started graduate school and at Penn and then at Chicago and then for 16 or 17 years at the University of Virginia. And I thought the job of a teacher, or at least how to be a good teacher, is you provoke a variety of emotions during class, you get people to look at things from different perspectives, you lead them through a path which sometimes is uncomfortable, and then you resolve it. And so there can be like a dramatic structure to a class. And so that's the way I always taught, and I always trusted my students and felt that they trusted me. And then I moved to NYU in 2011, and it's not so much moving from UVA to NYU, it's that suddenly, for the first time in the spring of 2014, I mean, it really was overnight. It was like from out of nowhere.
It was really strange.
In the spring of 2014, I had several incidents where students reported me to the dean and demanded that he do something about things I'd said in class, like teaching the Milgram experiment. One student thought that I was saying that the Nazis were okay. It was just this level of,
You shouldn't have said that. They weren't okay.
So, there was just the sense that students would give you the benefit of the doubt because you're all in this together, you're trying to put on a great class together, that seemed to vanish after a couple of such complaints, and I was really puzzled. And one student was talking about issues in terms of I don't feel safe, and I was like, what do you mean? I couldn't understand it. And this was all in the spring of 2014, and so when Greg invited me to lunch in May of 2014, you know, it's sort of like, you know, like you're seeing, you know, people turn into zombies here and there, and suddenly a guy comes along and says, you know, in the lab, I just found this new kind of parasite. And so he told me his idea. I said, oh my God, this is brilliant. And I said, and I sort of suggested, oh, you should write that up, and I should write it up with you. that was the Origin of the Atlantic article.
A question for all of you. The one thing that all of you have in common is that you live on the East Coast of the United States in relatively privileged areas.
Queens.
John.
Southeast D.C.
John, you just mentioned Penn, Chicago, Virginia, NYU. I don't see the University of Southern Kentucky on that list.
Right.
How certain are you that the phenomenon you're describing is national?
Oh.
Or do you think it is specific to privileged quarters of pampered American life?
Let me take that for starters. Because as we've been talking about the book around the country, I always ask a few different questions. And when I meet with administrators, I ask various questions. And one thing that I found is wherever you go, anywhere in America, if you're dealing with kids born after 1995, everybody from the college president through the professors, through the guitar teacher, through the counseling center, everybody is saying, what hit us? The anxiety, the depression, there's a tsunami of it. The soccer coach says, I mean, like all of a sudden, if you criticize a kid, you know, she won't come back to, you know, she quits the team. And so the fragility, the anxiety, the depression, that is totally national. The politicization of it, the idea that people are vulnerable, not me necessarily, but her and him and them, they're vulnerable, and therefore I'm gonna call you out and destroy you because you said something that I, you know, et cetera. It's that call out culture, that is not national. That is, if you look at the top liberal arts colleges in the Northeast and the West Coast and Chicago, you find it. In fact, that's where all the shoutdowns have been. We have a map at Heterodox Academy. We created a map where every shoutdown, where a speaker was literally shouted down so they couldn't speak, and it's all right along the Eastern Seaboard and the rim of the Pacific Coast and Chicago.
Yeah.
So what's special about Lenora, why don't you start with...
Wait, I had a Kentucky story. I couldn't believe it. You mentioned a state that I know something about. So can I just tell you where
Yes. We're always open to Kentucky stories.
This is... that's the 92nd Street Wise motto, where Kentucky stories live.
Highly specific.
Right. That's why I come here. So this lady wrote to me about a month ago. She's in Kentucky, and... Every afternoon when her son, who's 9, gets dropped off by the school bus, the rule that the school has is that there has to be an adult waiting at the bus stop to walk him home. It's actually, you can see her house from the bus stop. And she has her father normally walk him home. One day the dad was in the bathroom, and one day the kid wasn't supposed to come home, and so the grandfather wasn't waiting to walk him home. But if it becomes a third time, she gets reported to Child Protective Services because she is neglecting this child, and the child has to go back to the bus depot, which seems like the least safe place you could possibly take a kid in Kentucky. But so you're wondering, how do kids get so fragile? They're being told, they're being forced to be supervised every single second, even in Kentucky. And then the rationale for that is that otherwise they're not safe. And it's like, they are safe, but if you're always being told that you're not safe, when you are safe, nothing seems safe. And I think that's why we hear the word, I don't feel safe on campus, because that's just become the watchword for everything.
And if I could just add one thing on the class issue, and I take the class issue extremely seriously, and in the book we recommend several books, including Putnam's Our Kids, which I think is just absolutely fabulous. I do feel like in my work at FIRE, we still see at schools that tend to be more sort of working class, more commuter schools, we still see cases exactly like the kind of cases I was seeing in 2005, where students are being told that they can't protest outside of a tiny little free speech zone. A lot of these sort of like administrators throwing their weight around, don't you dare criticize the university case. But when it comes to these highly ideological cases, we do see them at more elite colleges.
A couple questions. John, you mentioned something happened around students born in 1995. Mm-hmm. Well, let's dig into this.
Okay.
What happened in 1995? And Lenore, you can chime in on this. This shift that you have identified in attitudes of parents, can you also locate the point at which this?
I can't locate it perfectly, but I can tell you that it is this generation and possibly a little bit of the generation right before it. You know, 1984, we started putting the pictures of the missing kids on milk cartons, and we neglected to say, by the way, this was a runaway, or this kid was taken in a custodial dispute.
Yep.
Right, in a divorce battle. And I think if you're growing up with, you know, here's your Rice Krispies, and here's the person who's been missing, it's really, there's a parade of them, you know, it's like, who's it, it's like, you know, it's like a series. And so that, I think, became, you know, we really became obsessed with the idea of predators and no child ever being safe. And that's when the crime really was ramping up.
Yeah.
From, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, it peaks in 93, but the fear keeps going even though the crime went down. So I can't say exactly when, but I do feel like this idea that any child that is not supervised is going to be snatched off their bike starts with the milk cartons.
But I think that's more the background, that's the pre-story. Mm-hmm. So Greg and I structured the book around this mystery of why is it so sudden? Why did it come out of nowhere with kids born in 1995?
Mm-hmm.
And so we think there's six different intersecting threads that really all come together. And that is one of them. That is the background of increasing paranoia. And Lenore's always talking about this. Somehow in the 90s or early 2000s, we got the idea that if you take your eye off your kid just to reach for a carton of milk, they're gonna be snatched.
Milk again!
That's right. But we think that there's two major factors here that combined. So one is the vast overprotection. The central idea in the book is that human beings are anti-fragile. That is, kids might look fragile, but actually the evolutionary design is for us to go out, fall down a few times, then we learn how to stand up. We reach for something, it drops, we learn how, you know. We're built to learn by trial and error, where kids seek out risk. Once they master something, they try to make it more dangerous. That's what they need to do. And beginning maybe in the 90s, we started saying, risk? How about zero? How about no risk? Is that good for you? And so we basically deprived them of the ability to develop their normal abilities as an autonomous human being. So that really ramps up in the 90s. And so we begin to get a more fragile generation. We begin to get kids who are not as robust. And then social media, I think, is the reason why the cutoff is so sharp.
Yeah.
Because Facebook opens up, it used to just be for college students when it came out, and then in 2006, now it opens up to anybody who lies and says they're 13. But, you know, but 11-year-olds aren't really getting on Facebook in 2006. And then the iPhone comes out in 2007, but it's expensive, and so 11-year-olds don't really have iPhones in 2007. But by 2011, they mostly do. Most teenagers now have an iPhone and social media, and they're checking it hundreds of times a day. There's a wonderful book called iGen by Gene Twenge. This is what really clued us into the sharpness of it.
Yep.
You look at the behavior changes that happened. The late millennials are still getting driver's licenses. They still sometimes drink with their friends. And they still sometimes go out on dates and go to work at jobs. But beginning with kids born in 1995, all that plummets because all they're doing is sitting home alone on their devices. And if you do that, it seems, if you get social media in college, it doesn't seem to be bad for your brain. But if you get it at age 11, 12, or 13, now your brain is just beginning to develop, and your parents let you have your device at night, so you're sitting there, and somebody just commented on something you said, and you know, you're trying to go to sleep, but you're worried about it. And so if you imagine 11 to 13-year-olds bathed in stress hormones and not sleeping year after year, yeah, suddenly, when they show up in college in September of 2013, yep. It's like from out of nowhere.
Yeah, it did line up extraordinarily well when we were looking into it. And I think of social media, John and I think of social media as something that really sped up two different factors. Certainly, you know, the depression and anxiety, if you look at the data, you know, when people use a lot of it, they tend to be more depressed. It doesn't explain enough of the variance, but—
It's a small effect that we can prove, but
right,
it is there.
Right, it is there. But when people are a little skeptical of this, the way I try to, and it disproportionately hits girls, and the way I try to explain it is, imagine the absolute worst of junior high school, 24 hours a day, forever. and then they immediately get it. But the other thing that it sped up, that both John and I are very interested in, and we do actually see as a causal factor, had been the much slower process of group polarization, particularly political polarization. And really, social media pats you on the back for having an echo chamber, whether it's on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. Essentially, it gives you a nice dopamine rush the thicker your echo chamber is. So I actually think social media speeds up both the depression and anxiety and the group polarization. So a lot of trends, one trend that was actually working was relatively quick, sped up like crazy as soon as we had social media.
Yeah. So here's my question. I really only have one question.
Mm-hmm.
This,
yeah.
This is
okay, better be a good
Must
one.
Must be a big one.
there was the greatest generation. Mm-hmm. Right? People who grew up during the Depression fought in the war. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they graciously and modestly accepted the term greatest generation tells you something about how great they were. But so the greatest generation looked at the generation that followed, the baby boomers, and said they were narcissists.
Yep.
And blamed television. Mm-hmm. And there was the famous phrase, the me decade, right? And there was an established narrative of generational complaint. Mm-hmm. That here they are, we sacrificed, and these people are all about themselves. Mm-hmm. The baby boomers then turned around and looked at Generation X. What did they say, remember? They said they were aimless. Mm-hmm. There was that whole notion, why were they aimless? Because of video games and heavy metal music, and possibly gangster rap.
And right? D&D.
And there was, I am old enough to remember, books written on the many flaws of Generation X and how we were going to be. What did Generation X do? Well, they turned around. Are you Generation X, Joe?
I'm last of the baby boom.
Oh, you're last. Are you Generation X?
X, yep.
Yeah. All right, well, direct
Mike. Doesn't
ask
me.
So, Greg, you then turned around.
Yep.
And you looked at the generation that came below you, and you said, they're soft.
Yep. Right?
Everyone's got a problem with the generation below them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why can't I just say, oh, this is more of what's been going on forever?
I can start this one, because I have fun with this one.
I'm quite sure, in fact, that if we went back to the 18th
actually, Socrates.
Century,
Socrates has
Socrates
a line.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Kids these days.
George Washington looked at those whippersnappers at, you know, and just said, they don't want to cross the whatever river it was.
But,
you know,
they want their moms to cross.
Well, when the original article came out, The Atlantic had someone who wrote a letter that was basically like, oh, you know, it's just the two old guys complaining about the younger generation, and they had a picture of Abraham Simpson from The Simpsons that was old man shouts at cloud. But I had fun answering it for two reasons. One, you know, just saying that people always say this, it's more of it's not really an argument. It's just saying that like this is a truism. And I, but also one thing that I like to point out is, you know, my grandfather was born in 1889 in Russia. His grandfather was a serf. And while I do say, like, listen, I actually think there was some validity as a Generation Xer when they were saying that we were aimless, I kind of think we were aimless. I think that when the silent generation picks on the baby boomers, there's endless things to pick on the baby boomers about, and they were right. So intergenerational critiques aren't necessarily automatically wrong. In fact, sometimes there's some truth to them. But given the tremendous amount of comfort and progress we've had just over the last two centuries, it is the case that you can say pretty reliably that everyone's grandfather had it grandmother had it a lot harder than they do. So what is the solution? It's not that we say, oh, it needs to be hard like it was in the good old days. The best possible thing that we could imagine having is a world in which we enjoy the fruits and comforts and video games and media of the current age, but are able to also draw from the tremendous wisdom that was brought by much harder times, from people like Seneca or Marcus Aurelius or the Buddha.
Yeah. And I'd like to add to that by saying there's a psychological principle that losses loom larger than gains, and so each generation is different from the one before, and the older one looks at them and says, well, they don't have this thing that we have, therefore they're deficient, and we don't notice the thing that they do have that is good. Mm-hmm. That's the normal process. That is eternal. That's not what we're talking about. That's part of it. That's fine. But above and beyond that, if you look at objective measures of functioning, such as the number who cut themselves to the point where they have to be hospitalized, that's not just like, we think that's bad, but you know, for them, I mean, it's a good thing, you know.
Absolutely.
So, so this is what is so stunning, is by objective measures, kids born after 1995 are cratering in their mental health. Yeah. Now, the stats, if you look at self-reported depression, anxiety, they go way up beginning with that birth year. Colleges are overwhelmed by people coming in saying they're depressed and anxious, not schizophrenia, not bipolar, not anything else, just depression and anxiety, not even stress. They're not more stressed, they just don't know how to deal with it. But here's the kicker. Many people say to us, oh, you know, that's just self-report. Like, these young people, they're so comfortable talking about depression. It's not a real thing. And if you look at the graphs of hospital admissions for cutting yourself, the graph for boys actually is fairly low, and that actually does not go up. The boys don't change. But the girls, the millennial girls just sort of go like this. The older iGen girls, or the graph of late teens girls goes like this. And the graph of 11 to 13 year olds from around 2000, we get right here, we get to 2013, it goes like this. It's tripled. Three times as many girls are putting themselves in the hospital, preteens. Same thing for suicide. The rate's way up. And these exact trends are exactly the same in the UK and in Canada. So that's why we think it's a combination of overprotection, which is happening in all those countries, plus the specific spur of social media, which specifically affects girls a lot more than boys.
Yeah, how severe the increase in anxiety and depression? If I was to talk about like the two things that really surprised me in working on the book, the first one was how bad all of the data was on the increase in anxiety and depression. And you know, that's whether it's self-reports, it's whether what we're hearing actually from people on the ground, and that's what we're seeing from things that you can't effectively fake. That scared me to death. It was much worse than I ever thought. The surprising thing that really struck me about the book, particularly as someone who has a one-year-old and a three-year-old, was how well established it is that kids need free time, free play, unstructured time. And I felt like I talked to a number of experts who were practically yelling this, you know, basically saying this is really well established.
Kids need free time!
Yeah, exactly. And meanwhile, you know, with my kids, when I look at other people in Washington, D.C., my age, like they're scheduling them from, you know, 6 a.m. to 11 a.m., like this is not, to 11 p.m., like this is not a thing. Mm-hmm.
Gotta enrich them.
Right. Let me ask the question another way. What's good about the current generation? So if we go back to the generational paradigms that I was describing earlier, we can say that the greatest generation were selfless and thrifty, mm-hmm. but they were also emotionally stunted and, you know, you name it, mm-hmm. cheap, I mean, whatever. we can say that the baby boomers were narcissists, but we can also say on the flip side, they were, you know, open to human difference, much more tolerant of diversity, you know, in each case. So. Is there a flip side to all the things you're describing that's actually beautiful and positive about what this generation is doing?
Yeah, well, the data in iGen shows what we kind of all know, which is that to them, you know, differences in sexuality are just not a big deal. You know, when we were growing up, it was like, you know, are you pro-gay marriage, anti-gay marriage? But it was like a thing, and to them it's like, who cares? Right. So the march of tolerance, which has been going on for decades and decades, is certainly marching on. So they're incredibly tolerant. They're much less likely to drink, do drugs, have premarital sex, all sorts of things that get teenagers in trouble. The flip side of that, of course, is teenagers probably need to get in a little bit of trouble to test the limits. And so, you know, we can point to specific bad things that they're not doing, but I think it is ultimately a stunting of ability, which means that it's not just like, well, it's this and that. I think it really is, as Twenge puts it, by all the markers of development, an 18-year-old today is at the level of a 15-year-old from 30 years ago. And this is why Greg and I recommend in our book, we should consider not having 18-year-olds on college campuses. They're really not ready for it, a lot of them. And so the norm should be a gap year. And this might be the only way to get kids away from their overprotective helicopter parents. Right. So, you know,
you think that's going to get them away. You're wrong.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They're going to be tracked. What I was going to say about this generation is it all is not lost. I mean, we do in their book, Let Grow has a couple of ideas that are really practical and really simple to give kids back the independence that will lead to more resilience. And one of them is just, it's called the Let Grow Project. It's not even a project. It's the teachers telling the kids to go home and do one thing on their own without their parents. It's homework. And when kids do it, it breaks the cycle pretty fast because the parents are so proud that the kid has done, oh my God, my kid got a Slurpee, yay, you know, high five. But that changes the parent as much as the kid because finally they've been forced to let the kids go and do something in the real world. And the reinforcement of the pride that the parents feel allows them to do it again. Mm-hmm. And with people like us saying, free time is good and kids need some independence, between that and having a push from the school, and everybody in the school is doing it, so you're not the crazy mom, that's really, I mean, that can just reset the whole thing. I mean, I know that sounds pretty easy and self-serving, but it can really change things fast.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. And one of the things that I wanted to add was, you know, it put fire in a little bit of my group, the Defends Free Speech on Campus, in a little bit of an odd position, because for years we'd been sort of lamenting sort of the apathy. Back when students were very good on free speech, they also could be a little apathetic, but they would, you know, join the petition saying, save Professor Blah, you know, sometimes a lot more than the Professor Blah's colleagues. But we were put in somewhat of a strange position where there was suddenly, you know, some real activism on campus, and some of it was great, and some of it was, however, activism that was requesting that people be fired for what they said, or for the using free speech to argue for new speech codes. So we had to say, it's kind of like, we're glad you've overcome the lack of apathy, we're not totally psyched about the fact that some of it seems to be directed at freedom of speech. I think there is, you know, a desire to improve and change the world, when you actually see, it's hard to tell what the best aspects of a generation is going to be until they start getting out into the workplace and starting really making their mark.
But wait, so I'm getting more confused, not less.
That's our goal.
So the current generation is more tolerant, more open to people of different sexual orientations,
right.
Less likely to use drugs and drink heavily. I'm assuming that we could make some comments about that they might be more empathetic. Mm-hmm. Certainly, they're what you're describing are right. People who have whose antenna for other people's mm-hmm. Pain and feelings is so. Why can't we just say that we have traded one set of trade-offs? We have exchanged one set of trade-offs for another.
Yeah, I'd like to take that.
Sure.
So, first of all, most kids in this generation are actually doing fine. Most are not suffering from depression, anxiety. Most come to college. They want to learn. The problem is that with this new morality, a subset have been empowered to call others out. This is the heart of the reason why we all should be alarmed, very alarmed. So think about it like this. Suppose you married someone who, no matter what you said, he or she just always took it in the worst possible way. They were always looking to prove that you're bad, you're wrong, and that was just constant. That would be really hard to be married to such a person. And now imagine that you admit students to your school and 5% of them are like this, and you're a professor and you always trusted your students, but no matter what you say, 5% of them are looking for some way to report you to the dean. It changes your teaching. You don't trust them. And when trust leaves a university, the fundamental character changes and basically it can't really function. And then imagine that these students that began graduating in May of 2017, imagine that you run a small company, you have a tight-knit team, and you hire one of them. And this person is always looking to call someone out. There's even a review of our book. Thank you for writing this book. Now I understand why all our bright new young hires go running to HR as soon as they overhear a joke in the hallway. I've heard from so many business people now in the last year, it's like, it's an unending soap opera. We're all so exhausted because somebody said something, somebody got angry, and this is taking up all our time. So when this call-out culture, which was nurtured in the university, in certain universities, especially in the Northeast and the West Coast, this call-out culture, industries that hire from those, so journalism, media, and tech, talk to people in those fields about their young employees, and they'll say they're making life a nightmare. There's no trust anymore. Everybody's walking on eggshells. Yeah. That makes it very difficult to be creative. It makes it difficult to be cooperative.
Wait, no. I will say, John, I am broadly in sympathy with you, but the notion that everyone's life is a nightmare in tech.
Not everyone.
Yes. My experience, limited as it may be, with Silicon Valley is they're doing just fine. And if they have problem with people running to HR because it's usually because their bonus is, you know, six figures as opposed to seven. Mm-hmm.
Right. A year ago, that was true. Talk to people now. This is very new.
Yeah, and when it comes to tolerance for things like sexual diversity and sexual expression, that definitely pulls well. But it's hard to kind of also at the same time say tolerance, because when you look at sort of the speech policing that comes from the most activist members of the community, it's just so easy to get in trouble for even, you know, what might be a faux pas in any other time in history. And so one of the interesting things is also in the data that shows kind of the polarization of our society is sometimes you can surprise people by saying, and actually did you know that in iGen, you know, people born after Gen Z, people born after 1995, that they're actually more conservatives. And people are kind of surprised when you say that. And it's like, and they're more liberal. Just there's a lot fewer moderates. Polarized. So some of the polarization of our overall society is actually reflected in our students. And what I get worried about is sometimes the way the arguments actually happen on campus. And the way of actually trying to show that you're tolerant and open-minded, it becomes what I call a perfect rhetorical fortress, where essentially it's just ad hominem questions without ever getting to the substance of the actual argument. Now again, it can be a minority of students, but it can prevent you from getting to the rich,
the
dynamic of the discussions you can have.
Would you feel differently if you were a gay person of color mm-hmm. who grew up in the South in the 1950s mm-hmm. And was looking at the world from that perspective?
What's actually kind of funny about that is I got approached by the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, and I'm a big comic book nerd, and they sensed that about me. And I've been talking to someone who very much follows that description, and he's a gay man, he's Latino in his 40s, and suddenly he's finding that he's being reported to the bias response team because he's not saying everything exactly right. So I think it depends on which one you talk to, but I am hearing this from a lot of people who are, by every sort of privileged dimension, not someone you would consider sort of like the oppressor, you know, coming to us saying, listen, like I'm suddenly the oppressor. I'm suddenly like the bad one because I don't say things exactly by this very regimented way that you're now supposed to at my comic book art school. So I actually think that from a number of them, you could actually, I mean, this was interesting for a friend of mine who went to Vanderbilt. She's a gay woman and she had friends, you know, obviously on campus, but she also was friends with a big part of the gay and trans population of Nashville. And she was, and this is a former intern of FIRE, and she said that she was told quite explicitly by the LGBT group at Vanderbilt not to bring the kids from Nashville, the townies, the gay and lesbian kids from town, partially because they were constantly offended by the way these other kids would talk. So there is something very, there's an elitist aspect to it that is actually quite exclusionary, that actually ends up being used against, in some cases, people you would assume would be the people it was designed to protect.
But I think we can go even further with this. I think we can acknowledge the idea behind your question, which is where privileged middle-aged white men analyzing a generation that is, sorry,
well,
in the book, I mean, in the book, where we talk a lot about Lenore Skenazy.
That's right.
Where privileged.
Great book. It's a great book.
So. And of course, a lot of the activism on campus, originally it was especially about racial issues and then LGBT and gender issues, and now it's about everything, it seems. But I certainly agree with your point that people would look at this from different perspectives. But the book is organized around three psychological principles, three great truths that are as true for black as they are for white, gay, straight, I mean, they're true for all human beings. So the three great untruths that we think kids are being taught are, what doesn't kill you makes you weaker, always trust your feelings, and look at life as a battle between good people and evil people. And if you're a human being, those are probably the three worst ideas we could possibly put in your head if we want you to flourish. And so, thank you. And so, one of the best lines in the book, one of the best things that gets retweeted and quoted a lot, is a quote we have from Van Jones. So, you know, Democratic activist, speaks at the University of Chicago, where they had an issue, they had somebody from the Trump campaign speak, and some students protested. And so David Axelrod asks Van Jones, what do you think about this, you know, no platforming, safe space stuff? And Van Jones, you know, he's clearly been thinking about this, and it's amazing what he says. He basically, more or less, he says, I don't want you to be safe ideologically. I don't want you to be safe emotionally. I want you to be strong. That's different. I'm not going to pave the jungle for you. Put on some boots and learn how to deal with adversity. So he's saying, if you're gay, if you're black, whatever you are, you need to be strong in this world. And going down this road of, oh, you know, you're so delicate, you're such a victim, we're going to protect you, that's the worst thing you can do to those people.
But what if it's the, I'm sorry to keep coming back to this, I mean, and I, these are all comments made in the spirit of affection for this argument.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We like critics, critics.
But this is just a little nub of it that troubles is too strong a word, that I can't get around.
It mm-hmm. triggers you.
It triggers me. let's go back to the example I gave her. I'm a young black man living in southern Georgia in 1950. Mm-hmm. What does my life look like? Well, my life is full of lots and lots and lots of both small slights and significant structural impediments. Both matter. Mm-hmm. I am demeaned, or it's even worse if I'm a woman. I am demeaned on a daily basis through language, through attitudes, through reinforcement of my inferior status, and through, more than that, through a general feeling by the white majority that I should be okay because I should just be able to buck it up and try hard and mm-hmm. I could make it in America if I stop whining about racial prejudice, right? That was the line mm-hmm. that was fed to black Americans for how many hundreds of years in this country. You know, there's a wonderful, there is an awful moment I was listening to a podcast, not my own, and there was a quote from someone in the, what podcast is, doesn't matter, but it was a quote from a white guy in the South in the 1960s who was saying, you know, we've had 3 years of this civil rights nonsense. All right, enough already. You know, let's just shut up about black people and let's get on with our lives. That is a kind of manifestation of this idea that if we just tough it out and stop whining, everyone's going to be fine. I'm not saying that. Yeah. What I'm saying is that this notion that that small slights don't matter does not have a distinguished history.
Uh-huh.
It was part and parcel of a way in which women, minorities, all kinds of people were for many years kept down, right? So what we're seeing now is evidence of an overcorrection on the other side, why is that a bad thing?
Yeah. Well, if you're talking about places where the laws say you don't have equal rights and the norms say you're garbage and you've got to move out of our way, that's a terrible situation. And there are times and places when you have to have aggressive and well-organized protest to try to knock things down. Yale University in 2015, Middlebury College in 2017, we're talking about places that are trying as hard as they can. The ethos, the culture is explicitly anti-racist, progressive, welcoming, inclusive. So the strategies that were completely legitimate at a time when there were actually legal barriers, it's a completely different world mm-hmm. from the one that we're talking about here on campus.
Yeah, and one of the things, a study that came out that actually so played into my own experience, I was immediately suspicious of it, was the Hidden Tribes study, which came out in the past, just a couple months ago. And basically my experience with a lot of the more aggressive kind of speech policing was it wasn't a poor black person from Georgia, it was generally a wealthy white person who's going to a very elite college. And that had been most of my experience of campus censors. They were elite, there are people who came from wealthy backgrounds. And one of the things that was in the Hidden Tribes study was talking about, like, the people who are the most passionate about this really aggressive form of speech policing is about 8% of the population. It's the highest economic class of any of the groups, and it has the least amount of actual racial diversity of every group except for the farthest to the right 8% group. So in a lot of times, and I've watched this happen over and over again, where people are saying, but what about this completely other situation, some other place, and that's why I should be policing microaggressions, but it takes the form of this very kind of like almost Victorian kind of at Stanford, you know, that essentially I'm going to police speech in the name of these people that actually I don't really know very well, but I know that this is a great evil, so I can make up for it somehow by being extra strict about what you're allowed to say. So in a lot of cases, what I see in this is a lot of classism, but the classism is partially coming from the speech policers.
Good. I want that concussion.
I'm going to say one. I'll make one last point, and then I will respectfully retreat back to my. But here's another thing that I can't get around. You're simultaneously making two claims, mm-hmm. right? One is a claim that we are on the, and I'm exaggerating only slightly, we are on the brink of a highly significant social catastrophe. Mm-hmm. And then simultaneously, both you and Greg, not you.
Not me.
Talk about how it's a minority. It's, in your case, it's 5% who are ruling it for everyone, and then we just had the 8% from you.
Thanks.
You know, if in fact this movement is undermining the culture of high-tech firms in Silicon Valley. How can 5%? Mm-hmm. Like 5% is a very small number. When were the noisiest 5% of any generation ever fun to hang out with? By the way, and a lot of your complaints are rooted in the behavior of students at relatively elite universities. When did students at relatively elite universities ever conform to our expectations of how adults ought to behave?
Yep.
You know, all of us, it's just the dysfunction took different forms. In my school, it was a complete absence of connection to any meaningful social issues whatsoever. I could have used a lot of what's going on at Stanford now. Mm-hmm. I almost would have thought it was a more morally engaged experience mm-hmm. as opposed to people just prepping for finance jobs. So I don't know. I mean, I'm struggling with the. Okay. I'm struggling with the why I should have anything more than a kind of academic interest in this trend.
Because the dynamics of a group, the dynamics of a culture, is not a majority vote. One of the big findings of the Hidden Tribe study, the study that was put out by a group in the UK, but it's a huge study of America, is that majorities of every single group, male, female, old, young, black, white, majorities of every group dislike political correctness, except for that group that is called the Progressive Activist Group on the far left. Yeah. So almost the great majority of people dislike political correctness, but we don't take a vote and say, you know what, most of us don't like it, therefore it's not gonna affect us. It's not like that. Rather, we are all responding especially to threats. So it's one thing if 5% are kind of annoying, and you know what, they might say something annoying to you. You can put up with that. But what if instead we arm everybody with a little blowgun and they can shoot darts into you and it really hurts. Like it really goes into your skin and an inch in, it really hurts. And everybody's got one and 5% of them are just going around blowing them at like anybody who looks askance at them. Mm-hmm. I think I'd change my behavior. I think we all have. That's basically what happened on campus. Most of our students are great. But the fact that there is a poster in every bathroom at NYU telling students how to report me if I say anything they don't like. I change my behavior. I don't say anything they might not like.
And I have 2 points about that. One is just that it's also, that lines up with the Hidden Tribes study, is that these are, tends to be people from fancy schools. And in my opinion, we actually privilege people from fancy schools probably a little bit too much. Maybe this will actually be the time when some people start realizing, wow, I'm actually having a lot of trouble with the people I'm hiring from Yale and Stanford. Maybe I should be hiring more from University of Indiana.
Hello?
Which actually,
how hard is this?
Which absolutely.
They're all a problem. Stop hiring.
Which I actually think would potentially be a great outcome. So they are disproportionately influential people. And I'm not sure, and I think we give too much praise to people from fancy schools. The other thing that we just really have to get back to, though, is the mental health aspect of it. Nobody benefits from the kind of numbers we're seeing in terms of anxiety, depression, particularly when it's avoidable, particularly when you have a situation in which people are more or less creating an environment that are causing people to believe that they are mentally fragile when they're actually anti-fragile. To believe, to talk themselves into depression and anxiety, that's the thing that scares that scares me the most personally, that there's no upside to a huge increase in anxiety and depression in society. So that's one of the reasons why I think everybody should take this seriously.
And, yeah. And it's not the kids talking themselves into it per se, it's if you've been growing up and you've only been in the back of the SUV and you've been taken every place and there's always an adult organizing your life and mediating all your disputes and telling you what to do, that creates anxiety because you don't really have the internal locus of control.
Right. Yeah. The world really is a scary place. If you don't have an internal locus of control, you're a victim of circumstance. That's what they tell you.
And you've been told that everything out there is scary, and that's why you have to be with an adult all the time.
And I don't want to leave with the idea that we have some kind of I really feel genuine compassion for a lot of these students, because I think about Julie Lithcott-Haynes, who wrote a wonderful book called How to Raise an Adult. And she was the dean of freshmen at Stanford. And what she was seeing was these absolutely brilliant students who weren't spoiled. They were built like heat-seeking missiles. They were perfectly refined, perfectly designed to get into the Princetons and the Harvards and all of these fancy schools that we disproportionately value. But unfortunately, they hadn't been taught how to do their own laundry, how to actually manage their lives.
Yeah.
And when you don't have a locus of control, that is a perfect formula for having anxious and depressed people. And there's something really heartbreaking about the kind of stories Julie tells about these incredibly accomplished people who feel powerless in their own lives, that I think it should be a tragic and effective to anybody who cares about next generation.
I promise. I said I was done, but I'm not. I have one other. I mean, this is. I literally am done. When I, the last time I was at the Y, was about a year ago, and it was to hear Ronan Farrow. In conversation with, and I'm blanking on her name, the actress. Rose McGowan, talking about Harvey Weinstein, and that was at that moment when we uncovered. Something catastrophic and heartbreaking about the culture of one of the central industries of our day, right? Hollywood. That here was a guy who was one of the most important figures, and he was a serial sexual abuser and had been protected by the culture for a generation, not more. Now, I'm looking at the three bad ideas in this book. And there are three ideas here that you just talked about, that are thought to be highly problematic. What doesn't kill you makes you weaker. Well, that's sort of what we said to the people who were victimized by Harvey Weinstein. We said to them, well, you should get over it. You're fine. You got, in some cases, maybe you got something out of it. This is not the same as blah, blah, blah. Second thing, always trust your feelings. A bad idea. Well, that was also what we did in the case of those women who were victimized in those cases. We told them that their feelings didn't matter, that the hurt that they carried for, in many cases, years and years and years, that had an extraordinary impact on their lives, was something that was of no concern to the broader culture, and that Harvey Weinstein should continue to be able to make great movies because that's a secondary thing. Mm-hmm. Three, life is a battle between good and people and evil people was a bad idea. Well, Harvey Weinstein is an evil person, by the way. And so are a lot of the other people who, Les Moonves is not a good person, right? And I could go down the list of people who use their power, we are now discovering, in ways that had a profound impact. So I understand that these ideas can be bad in certain contexts, but I'm not upset about the rise of these ideas in this moment, because I feel like there's still an awful lot of work that we have to do as a society to make society a equitable and, I hate to use it, safe place for everyone, not just white men from elite colleges, right?
I think we all agree about that.
We don't disagree, and this is something where I agree with Steven Pinker.
I use that move all the time as well, by the way.
That essentially kind of like a lot of the problems that we see are the results of good things taken too far. That essentially political correctness is an, like you said, it's an overcorrection. But lumping together, frankly, the idea of someone getting in trouble and people demanding they be fired for defending students' rights to wear offensive Halloween costumes is the same thing as what happened with Harvey Weinstein. These are really things of different orders. Now, hold on. And so basically, like, it is absolutely wonderful that we are coming out against these monsters, and they are indeed monsters. It's the same way I feel about the anti-bullying campaign. When the anti-bullying campaign started, people expected me to be like, oh, this is speech policing. And my response was, no, it's about damn time. We didn't need to be as cruel to each other when we were kids as when I was a kid. But every virtue taken to an excess turns to a vice. And I think that if you look at the kind of cases we talk about in the book, we're not talking about Harvey Weinstein cases. We're talking about professors making arguments in good faith, in thoughtful papers, and being treated like monsters for it. I want all the Harvey Weinsteins in the world to be exposed, and he's a rapist, to be arrested. But if you think the same thing applies to the Brett Weinsteins of the world, to the Rebecca Duvalls, I think that's quite another story.
But is it? Agreed. No, I totally agree. But I wonder whether you're being naive.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder whether you're being naive. I wonder whether it's realistically, is it possible to have the 90% good
mm-hmm.
without the 5% who take it too far?
Sure. If you have notions of rights and there are people who violate other people's rights and then we prosecute them, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, rape is not a microaggression. Sexual, what Harvey Weinstein was doing was illegal.
It was monstrous.
There you have it. Whether you accept or reject in part or whole the comments from those three panelists, at least it gave us an understanding what it is to go to school today to get an advanced education. Can you? Absolutely. Are there a lot of people going to school who really want to learn and then apply that learning in the real world? Absolutely. There's also a not-so-small group, generally coming from helicopter parents who hover over every move they make, micromanage their life, and generally more often not professionals, lawyers, doctors, engineers, academics, people with themselves an advanced education, and now they expect way too much from their children. And now we see the results of being coddled and being protected. And so these people actually believe that going to college should just be an extension of their home environment. Wow, things have changed. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying.